this week and next week. Next week, Garrett is going to lecture on the history of the Bible, which isn't really the entire Bible, but more or less translations and how they've developed and evolved over the last 100 years, predominantly as a product of Western Christianity. So you'll want to come back next week, and that'll be the last session. And then we will break for the summer, as is our typical process, and reconvene after school starts in the fall. I think we usually reconvene after Labor Day, so September, with brand new subject. So we've done church history as long as we have subject and stuff to talk about. So we'll turn our attention elsewhere. The subject matter for tonight is the last three chapters of the book, the last one of which really is just an epilogue. So really it's the final two, if you've been following along or reading along. If you haven't, what it does, really chapter 36 talks about the movements within Protestant Christianity in our country over the last 100 years, ever since really World War I moving forward. And it is it's a fascinating read. If you have the book, read chapter 36. It brings light to our current climate well, and that's part of what I wanted to talk about tonight as we think about it. World War I, if you think about a lot of the influences and things circulating in our country around that time period, you had between World War I and World War II, and you're going to have, of course, Great Depression take place during that time period. You have these big words that start surfacing, and the church, like everybody else, the church had a reaction and had an opinion to them. These are words like socialism, fascism, communism. In the midst of those, you have the Depression, what else? You're going to have, after World War II, you're going to have civil rights movement, and you're going to have feminist movement. But these are all, you know, when you think about what we're dealing with now from a governmental point of view, from a world relations point of view, there's so very much that we deal with in the church today that is parallel to what the church dealt with back in the 30s and 40s and 50s. The names have changed, the cast of characters have changed, but instead of in America people going around and trying to identify who are the closet communists and how you might be identified as a communist if you don't go to church or if you do mission work with people in communist countries, you might be a sympathizer and trying to root out those people, how we were... would take land away from Japanese Americans, American citizens of Japanese descent after World War II. The names have changed, but now we might feel the same way about Muslim extremists. We might feel the same way about, people from countries in the Middle East. It is not often that I say, on a handful of occasions since I've lived in Houston, I have met somebody that self-identifies their heritage as Persian. Anybody met somebody that identifies their heritage as Persian? What are they saying? They're saying, I don't want to tell you I'm from Iran. Yeah, I don't want people in this country to identify me with America's political feelings with my homeland. And so the names have changed a lot. If you go back, I'm just going to kind of follow the outline just for purposes of summary here. After World War I, the Great Depression comes, and of course, historians will say that the Depression of the 30s might not have been as great as the Depression of the late 18th century, but that America was in a more psychologically precarious position coming out of World War I. We come out of World War I, and Americans had a very different reaction to it than Europeans did, primarily being because the U.S. was not the battleground. I mean, we went and fought late, but the citizenship of our country didn't suffer a great deal of trouble as a result of World War I. Totally different story in many of the Western European countries. And so after World War I, there was this real theologically negative, critical feeling about the church and where it was moving forward. And in the U.S., that was just blank. It was kind of empty. To the U.S., the victory in World War I was a celebration. It spoke to hope for the future and how we conquer all, and we're going to move forward. We're God's chosen people, and you know, things of this nature. But then shortly after World War I, the Great Depression, the stock market crashes, and the Great Depression ensues. And then all of a sudden, some of these more realistic, troublesome theological ideas from Germany, from Europe, start filtering over, and people in the United States, in the midst of their suffering, a very different suffering. It wasn't suffering like Europeans had during the war, but in poverty and distress. Oh, by the way, during World War I, there were lots of Protestant preachers out there saying, these are the events of Daniel in Revelation. This is ushering in the end. The end is it's coming right now. Sound familiar? By the way, the preachers did the same thing during World War II. By the way, preachers have done the same thing about 10 times since then. The World Trade Centers were hit. This is Daniel in Revelation. The end is coming. if we go back and study Revelation again, and I share with you my opinion about Revelation as patterns within history instead of isolated future events, remember that. Remember that, because it just seems to cycle over and over again. This war that the dragon makes with the people of God. But we move into the Great Depression, and German theologians, a guy named Karl Barth, a couple of brothers that were of German descent but lived in the U.S., as you start moving towards World War II, from World War I, being a German of German descent in the United States was somewhat of a precarious position to be in, right? My family was in that boat. They were farmers. Farmers are a little bit more harmless than, say, scholars in the university. But the Niebuhr brothers are referenced in the book on page 478, Richard and Reinhold. Richard, at least with his name, could pass for a Brit or a Scotsman. Poor Reinhold, there was no hiding the fact that he was from Germany. But this references some of their writings. Richard published a book called The Social Sources of Denominationalism, in which he argued that denominationalism in the U.S. was an adaptation of the gospel to the various racial and socioeconomic strata of society, thus showing, and in quotes it says, the domination of class and self-preservative church ethics over the ethics of the gospel. Okay, let me read that one more time. He says, it shows that the domination of class, that's social class, and self-preservative church ethics triumph over the ethics of the gospel. This was an observation during the Great Depression era by Richard Niebuhr. I have to say that, you know, almost 100 years have come and gone, and as you look at the church in our country, I wonder if some of those same critiques would also still be true. That whatever our social class is, and the role of self-preservation of our church tradition and our church ethics means more to us than the ethics of the gospel. Again, the issues have changed. You know, one of the big issues coming out of World War I, we have enemies. Into the Great Depression, you know, there's this. We've got the Germans, but now we're looking for new people to hate. You know, after World War I, the Ku Klux Klan experienced one of its greatest periods of growth in its history. And they went from hating Germans to hating Jews to hating African Americans, basically anybody that wasn't just good old white Americans. We're looking for villains. We're looking for enemies. Prohibition is going to come out of this. We see alcohol as a leading factor of evil and wickedness and debauchery. And so the U.S. government outlawed buying and selling of alcohol It lasted about a decade. In the context of doing that, what did it serve to produce? Yeah. Gangs, mafia, warfare, all kinds of other crimes. Yeah, in trying to legislate morality in one area, we just created immorality and illegality in a handful of others. But within the church, especially the South, especially the Baptists in the South, that kind of created this entrenched idea that this is something that is anti-God. And we see in the Baptist church and in some other Protestant denominations that lingering vestiges of those ideas from 100 years ago still are prevalent today. Ku Klux Klan is in the rise. Depression comes. Niebuhr's identifying that the church cares more about its own self-preservation than it does the ethics of the gospel. And while the issues may be different, we still deal with race issues today. You don't have to go 24 hours in the news cycle and you don't hear a story about something pertaining to race issues. But some of the other issues, with Nazi Germany or German Americans or Japanese Americans or anti-Semitism towards Jews, some of those things may not be the same. Today it may be much more sexual orientation. The church, man, it just continues to not be able to get out of its own way in the way that it talks about and the way it does ministry to people whose sexual ethics are different than our own. And it will continue to be one of the probably for the rest of my lifetime in ministry, how we as a church, if we hold to a traditional understanding of sexuality, but do we give that preference of place over other issues of morality, in the same sense that the church in the South was trying to deal with slavery in the 50s and 60s, in the same way that the church in the 60s and 70s was trying to deal with women's rights, women's suffrage. The Bible says this: they had slaves. Paul writes a letter to a slave owner, and he's sending a slave back to him, and so we have slaves. So how do we deal with that? Things like this. The church, we continue to wrestle with the same problems, just the names and faces have changed. And so Niebuhr says, more concerned about self-preservation and traditions, the preservative ethics of the church, than we are about the ethics of the gospel. Be interesting to go read his book and see how he defines the ethics of the gospel. Obviously, that's an important definition there in understanding his quote. He also makes this, he says, his conclusion made all the more poignant because the world was nearing World War II, approaching its worst war. He makes the comment that a Christianity which surrenders its leadership to the social forces of national and economic life offers no hope to the divided world. That is strong words. That's convicting words. Let me read that one more time. A Christianity which surrenders its leadership to the social forces of national and economic life offers no hope to the divided world. By the way, that's not implying that we shouldn't be patriotic, that we shouldn't be political, that we shouldn't vote, that we shouldn't be good citizens. It's not implying any of that. But what it is implying is that as men and women of faith, our spiritual leadership shouldn't come from those places. Our hope should be something beyond that. Our trust should be in something beyond whatever it looks like our leaders, the social forces of national and economic life. And that will continue, by the way, to be a very difficult challenge for the church moving forward. As the communication cycle has become so pervasive, how do we as Christians stand for the kingdom of God first and foremost, and also represent ourselves as good, involved citizens of our country? How do we combine the two in a place that believes in separation of church and state? How do we operate with one foot in the church and one foot in our country, recognizing that they overlap some, but that they are not identical? These are issues not only of the Depression era, they're issues of the era in which we live in, which we happen to live in a recession era. It's not a depression era, but certainly similar. Richard's brother, Reinhold, was a parish minister in Detroit, it says. Reinhold pretty much just came out and became a socialist. He wrote a book called Moral Men and Moral Man and Immoral Society. And a couple of other German theologians, Paul Tillich, Karl Barth, that are referenced here. But during this same time period, post-war, well, this was prior to World War II, so then World War II comes. And, the U.S., at first, in the church, you had a contingency of, during the Depression, we have all these immigrants that have come in to do manual labor jobs out of the South, Latin America, Mexico, and now we're in a Great Depression. We don't have enough money or jobs for our own people, and so there's this backlash of pushing immigrants, even some that have become citizens, back out of the U.S. and back into Mexico and further south. So World War II comes, and there's already these sentiments against the other, whoever the other might be. If it's an immigrant, if it's somebody that represents the Axis powers or World War I causers, if it's somebody just different than you, there's already this. And so preachers in churches are preaching in favor of what's taking place in the early rises of socialism. The church can't decide if it wants to be if it's in favor of socialism, if it's in favor of fascism. Even early on, there were those within the Protestant church that would say, what Hitler seems to be doing, of course, this is before we start getting to mass executions, but just controlled environment, controlling people that are not like us. We're in favor of that kind of attitude. You know, it's interesting in all of the conversation today about socialism and what's going on in Europe with those countries that are full-blown socialists, claims, right, wrong, or indifferent about our current president, about people running for president. Did you know that? This was a big debate, even not within our government, but also within the church. Does the government have a responsibility, coming out of the Great Depression, does the government have a responsibility to take care of the poor, the unemployed, the hungry within its own country whenever times like this happen? Does the government have a responsibility in doing that? And you had people in the church that said, absolutely not. And you had people in the church that championed and were one of the leading forces in FDR's big deal and some of these things like Social Security being implemented, insurance for the unemployed being implemented, just anything that you see now as government help for the disabled, for unemployed, for the retirees, those kinds of things were not in place prior to the Great Depression. Coming out of the Great Depression, those things would be put in place, and the church was divided on it. Should the government do this? Should the government not do this? And ultimately, it became part of our landscape, and the church had a strong voice in that coming to pass. So, churches couldn't decide. Should we be socialists? Should we not be socialists? Should we be fascists? Should we not be fascists? One of the things that was almost always agreed upon was that we shouldn't be communists. If we're a fan of government being involved in some degrees, we're certainly not in favor of government being involved that much. So that was almost something that they usually stood in agreement on. But it was a very politically divisive age. They just didn't have all of the news cycle and social media and TV and everything else keeping the pot stirred up like we do today. Yes, Pat?
If you want a really eye-opening, shocking look, you need to go back and read the news magazines of the 30s.
Okay.
Because I did that one time kind of as a project, and you would be absolutely astounded. Magazines like Time.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. For the recording, what she referred to was going back and reading some of the news periodicals and magazines in the 30s, and just seeing how stuff that we don't even know or things that we take for granted didn't exist, and what a different environment pre-Depression era. I think Depression marks 1930, so that would have been, the 30s would have been Depression era. So World War II comes, and eventually, you know, the U.S., you had people preaching pacifism. We shouldn't be involved in this. You know, we only got involved in World War I at the 11th hour. This is not our fight. We should let this take care of its own. You had people saying we should just, you know, leave Hitler and Mussolini alone and let the chips fall where they may. You had people that felt like we should get involved. We should, you know, help out. Others said it's not our responsibility to be helping out in other places. And there was, the church was not in agreement and the country was not in agreement on what our involvement should be in World War II, obviously until Pearl Harbor, at which point, no matter what your theological opinions were, if you were not in favor of getting involved, you were almost viewed as a traitor, as unpatriotic. After the attack had hit us, then everybody was on board with us getting involved. He doesn't say a whole lot about World War II in here. Instead, he kind of transitions to the post-war decades and what would happen after that. After World War II, it was not long before Nazism was replaced with communism in the eyes of America as the big, scary monster. The communists are the ones we need to be afraid of. And in some cases, the Americans were more concerned about communists than they were even about the Nazis. I mean, even you think about World War II, Pearl Harbor, of course, being a tragedy that it was, every other battle, every other, you know, civilian casualties took place elsewhere. It didn't take place on U.S. soil. And for Pearl Harbor, that's U.S. soil, but far, far off the coast of the mainland. You move forward, and communism has taken over, and there was a lot of anti-communist sentiment and efforts at trying to root out closet communists and secret communists out of our country, even within the church. There was a season where if you didn't go to church, going to church is just, you know, during the 60s, going to church is what it means to be an American. And if you don't go to church, then what's wrong with you? Are you a communist? But even within the church, if there were churches that were trying to do ministry, missionary work with places that were communist, then there was kind of that lifted eyebrow, like, what are you doing going and doing missionary work with people in the Soviet Union? Are you sympathetic with their political views? Are you, you're helping them out? Why would you do that? It was this kind of climate of fear that we see today. Just again, the names and faces have changed, but we see it today. It was part of in this kind of environment that Billy Graham rises to power. And Billy Graham was, for his age, was cutting edge with communication. He kind of borrowed from some of the great revivals that we've heard about in the past, coming into a wave of popularity, winning the war, but also this little fear operating from from the Cold War that's beginning. And Billy Graham, the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association was formed. And of course, that's another interesting read, the history, his story and their history. I was talking with Garrett earlier as I was reading through this, and he said, neither he nor I lived, in the 60s and 70s. I was born in 76. But he said that Billy Graham really gained a lot of capital during that time period by being very anti-communist, very vocally anti-communist. And that made him popular. In addition to his gospel preaching, he also, we look at some of these big names and kind of look at them funny because they're evangelists, but they're also political activists. And Billy was, he did not mince words or spare words when he was talking about communists in the midst of the Cold War. Of course, his ministry was incredibly effective, in the context of evangelism crusades. One of his predecessors, a guy named Billy Sunday, who was a revival preacher and evangelist of a previous era, You know, again, this follows on the path of D.L. Moody. I think D.L. Moody was one of the first to kind of institute the evangelism crusade. And for those of you that don't know, the typical, you know, Protestant church practice of, you know, the end of the sermon, we have, you know, the people stand at the front and you have to walk down the aisle in order to come and make a response. That was born out of the evangelism crusades. That was not, that doesn't go back to Jesus or Peter. That doesn't go back to Jerusalem or even the Roman Catholic Church. That was evangelism crusades, where the whole purpose was fill a stadium with as many lost people as we can and preach a gospel and try and solicit a response from them. And that kind of carried over into some Protestant churches, Baptist in particular, but the attitude was that every service is for the purpose of sharing the gospel and drawing a response from people. Obviously, evangelism is important. Preaching the gospel is important. But if you've been around here long enough, you know my sentiment that discipleship is also important. If we get all of these people to make a response, but then we leave them floating adrift, Jesus tells a parable about that, about scattering of seed and seed that doesn't find any root, and what happens to those, you know, to those seeds. Today, there's the ongoing debate on what the purpose of the worship service is. Is the worship service for the lost? Is the worship service for believers? And Andy Stanley and I would disagree on that. He claims that the entire worship service is for the lost. And my question is, how can people worship if they're lost? The worship service is for believers. And it's an invitation for the lost to come in and see how we as a believing body do family business together and worship our God together and study the Word and learn and seek to grow and develop, and hopefully in the context of coming in and observing and watching and listening to what we believe, what the Bible says, then they find conviction within it, that the Spirit uses that as a source of conviction. It's probably not as black and white as either one of us would make it out to be, but Billy Graham, coming out of post-war, is certainly a key influence. Norman Vincent Peale, how many of you guys remember him? Faith and positive thinking as a route to mental health and happiness. Not long after World War II, we have civil rights movement, and the civil rights movement, of course, heavily led, I mean, obviously the black community in our country led it, but their primary leaders in that were pastors, church leaders. You know, and Martin Luther King Jr., not the first, probably one of the second, but the most prominent, eventually as Vietnam and our involvement in Southeast Asia came to be in the news cycle, you know, shortly after, he came to realize his work was as much anti-poverty and anti-social abuse as it was just social abuse against the black population of the U.S. He identified also in Vietnam and Southeast Asia some of these other things taking place that communists were doing. Martin Luther King was much more broad-minded, but of course in his context, it was largely civil rights. You know, the church in that context was sometimes a help and sometimes a hindrance. And while the church was rising up through figures like Martin Luther King, it was a response of pacifism, civil disobedience, Rosa Parks staying on the bus, but you also had other systems of belief that were much more militant that would rise up out of that. And I don't know that it's certainly the only ones, but Gonzalez references the black Muslims and some of those more, that the Islamic system of belief, as it was interpreted there, gave certain people a reason to rebel in a much more militant and violent fashion. And so you had both. Listen, don't we see that today? You have those in any underserved or any prejudiced community trying to operate the pathway of Martin Luther King, speaking out, using words, working within the system, being a peacemaker of sorts, but standing up for what's right. You have those whose response is much more violent, much more militant, much more warfaring-like. And then you have those within the church who will look at one segment usually the more militant and violent one, which may be the smaller one, and then paint the whole group with a broad brush picked up from the smaller sampling size. That's taken place with radical Islam. We take the examples of the extremists and paint the whole group with the broad brush of what radicals have done. By the way, the secular world in the United States does the same thing to Christians. They'll look at the Jonesboro Baptist group. They'll go back in history and say, look at these things. Look at Inquisition in Spain, or look at civil wars within the Christian churches in Europe during the Reformation, and the way the they'll point out the negative examples, though they may be small, and then they'll paint all of us with the broad brush of the negative few. It's almost comical the way that we allow our minds to be, through fear and through selective journalism, we allow ourselves to become trapped by fear, and we become fearful of anybody who is a different skin color or a different world religion or speaks a different language. So civil rights, I mean, some of those trends, obviously we've made progress, but some of those trends, it's funny, they still exist today. The feminist movement was another example. He talks about this on 487. Churches, within the church, churches coming to grips with what roles women can and cannot play, and this is still debated, by the way, in certain places. In the theological world, you had theologians. In fact, he quotes James Cone. Let me read this to you. This is Black Theology. James Cone was a seminary professor at Union Theological Seminary, which is in New York, and was an African-American and really worked at writing Christian theology from the perspective of the oppressed, which was something in a lot of cases, particularly in that time period, that most of the people in the seminaries and university life were white American males, and writing theology and telling people about the Bible and telling people about God, probably the least oppressed and least abused percentage of the population in that country at the time. And he comes along and he makes this statement. He says, there can be no Christian theology which is not identified unreservedly with those who are humiliated and abused. In fact, theology ceases to be a theology of the gospel when it fails to arise out of the community of the oppressed. For it is impossible to speak of the God of Israelite history, who is the God who revealed himself in Jesus Christ, without recognizing that he is the God of and for those who labor and are heavy laden. James Cone had a lot of radical ideas and is not widely considered orthodox, but him, as well as a Latin American theologian, and I should be able to call his name, and I can't. I always think Justo Gonzalez because he's the one that wrote this book. His last name was Gutierrez. But they came along and said, you know what, in the context of doing theology, you need to try and learn to see the world from, if you never lived in an oppressed, abusive society or environment, you need to be able to listen, and you need to be able to see, what does the gospel have to say for those that are not like us? What does the gospel have? Where does our theology speak to, these kinds of communities, oppressed and abused and beaten down and downtrodden? So that was, some of the trends that arose out of World War II. When I think about this movement, World War I to Great Depression to World War II to post-World War II, and those big ideas of communism and socialism and civil rights movement and things like that, prohibition, the feminist movement. I fast forward, not that long. I mean, we're not that far removed from World War II, 50 years. You come back around and we've seen the rise of terror, the war on terror. We've had our own economic recession, certainly not Great Depression-like, but it's caused people to be more fearful. Caused people to be, to hold on to their money a little bit more tightly. You still have socialism in play. It's still, a developing ideology. In our country, we still can't decide how much should the government be involved. Do we want them to be involved in Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, but we don't want them to be involved in gun rights and other kinds of things? It's an ongoing debate. And the church seems to be, man, right in the middle, trying to figure out, as far as the kingdom of God goes, we're concerned with the poor. We're concerned with the abused. We do want our government to be involved. At the same time, we know that our government is not God. Our government is not the church. And so, such a tangled web that we weave. we're not rooting out communists anymore, but I mean, how many attacks? Look, you don't have to have any more attacks by religious extremists, regardless of whether it's a racist-based attack at the AME church in South Carolina. That was not, Muslim-related at all. That was just white hatred and racism executed against black citizens of our country. Or whether it's something like in San Bernardino, California, where it very much is an acutely planned and executed, radical religious extremist attack. But we're already at the place where you're always kind of, looking, are they secretly communists? Are they supporting Soviet Union? But we might say, I wonder if they're supporting ISIS, or if they're going to websites to see how to build bombs, or if they're, so very interesting that the patterns haven't changed. When I think about this, the bigger question for me is, in light of the culture, in light of the environment where we are, people are just afraid. It seems like they're afraid. Just after yesterday, Donald Trump wins Indiana. It seems widely prevalent that he's going to be the Republican nominee. People are operating on the presumption that our next president will either be Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. And you get on Facebook and you would think the sky is falling. Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know. Maybe it is. But I go back to Ecclesiastes and I'm reminded that there's nothing new under the sun. what is old, what is new will become old, and what is old will pass away and become new again. In the grand scheme of things, there's tensions with people all over the world. We're certainly not in a world war with a Hitler, but all of this, refugee crisis in the Middle East with people trying to get out of Syria, trying to get out of Iraq, trying to, executions and things in Pakistan. It's not world war, but it is hostile relationships that kind of has the whole world's attention. It's affecting everybody in Europe. It's affecting us. It's affecting Mexico. I mean, we're not at war, but it's uneasy, right? Our country is fearful of what's taking place. And then in light of that, man, we sure make gun rights very, very important. Less, I would think, because of our independence, and more just because of fear. Yes. Yeah.
World War II, 4 years. The latest war in Afghanistan, we didn't have 10 years.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and I think, I think even right now, this whole, if we want to call it the war on terror, it has more to me in parallel with the Cold War, and that it's a battle of sorts, but it's not a World War II. It's kind of fought in cell, splinter cells and propaganda, but it just sows fear. It sows fear in the hearts of so many people. And then the church goes back to operating based on self-preservation instead of operating on an ethic of the gospel. We try to talk responsibly but carefully, here with the immigrant and refugee crisis, and how does the church respond to this? I mean, this is one of those things where, listen, the staff at your church, we don't have a political agenda at all. You know, I don't know enough about politics to stand up here and tell you I have a political agenda and I'm going to share with you what I think is right. I would really be the last person you should listen to when it comes to that. But just from a gospel agenda, the ethics of the gospel, how do we respond to that? Or do we operate from a position of self-preservation? I do think, our immigration system needs reform significantly. I think that that the way it is now is not good. But at the same time, immigration's one of the things that's made our country great. And I would hate for us to make it a debilitating process for people to be able to come here. The refugee crisis, we need to, when you listen to you read the blogs and listen to the sentiments that we have a responsibility to protect one another, protect our families, protect our kids. Who would argue with that? At the same time, an ethic of the gospel says that, I was hungry and you fed me. I was sick and you came and cared for me. I was in prison and you came to see me. Whatever you have done to the least of these, you have done unto me. That's a gospel ethic. Do we totally shun that because of fear, because of our quest for self-preservation? Is there a balance? Is there a compromise? Is there somewhere in the middle that we can say, yes, we want to be a place where refugees are welcome? Yes, we want a thorough screening process by which people can get into our country, especially if they're coming from countries of known, dissent and problem and trouble. The church is always supposed to have been the conscience of the government. All right, this goes back to Old Testament. It's the reason why David was a king but not a prophet. It's the reason why Saul, in large part, lost God's favor, because he did not respect the boundary between his political authority and the spiritual authority that was vested in others. And the church has always supposed to be, you got to have presidents and congressmen and leaders that operate more from a defense and protection and building. And I'm glad that they are who they are and I'm not them, because I'm not wired that way. And I'm glad they're thinking of those things. I wish they were all thinking the best for our country instead of the best for themselves. But the church is always supposed to be the voice of conscience to the political leaders. Nathan would come to David and say, you may be king and you may have all the authority, but this is the word of God to you, and you do with it as you please, but ignore it at your own peril. And so I think that's the challenge for us as a church, is to recognize that in 100 years of our history, we've progressed technologically a long ways, but socially and religiously, there's a lot of similarities to where we are today, to the same place we were 50 years ago, I think. It's interesting. Garrett made another good observation. He said, the Depression, post-World War II, the church kind of went back. It did a Ezra Nehemiah thing, where we come back out of exile, things have gone so badly, we're going to build our walls around the city, and we're going to build our walls of the law very stringently, and we are going to make sure we sequester ourselves from the world and stay separated from the world. And he said the church kind of did that after World War II. It became very, ritualistic, very legalistic, very separated from the world, and most of our society, most people went with them. When the church did that, people went with them, because there wasn't any other voices. They didn't have CNN. There wasn't a large preponderance of the world religion groups, New Age groups, back then like there are now. It says today, with some of the fear and some of the immorality and some of this, the ethical issues that are being debated, you see strains of the church reverting back to fundamentalism. This is the story of the Southern Baptist, by the way. Reverting back, digging into our trenches and holding back and saying, we're just losing ground, we're losing ground, we're losing ground. We got to hunker down and make sure we cling to our self-preservation. But his observation was, he said, you know, back in the 50s and 60s when the American people went with the church, whenever they went back to traditional religion, he said, there's a whole lot more voices competing today. There's a whole lot of other options and alternatives. And in a large way, what we see is the greater secularizing of our society may be in due part because instead of moving forward, the church has tried to regress. And a lot of people have said, you know what? We've got other voices and other options we're going to follow. We're going to keep going forward with secular ideas instead of the church transitioning. This conversation, by the way, I would never have this conversation on Sunday morning. These are things that I don't even have, you know, a complete grasp on. These are things that, as a pastor, they give me heartburn because I'm trying to think as a church, if these are the trends we see, and if we can think about where our society's going forward, what we need to be able to do is be a church that is a light that shares the gospel of Jesus Christ to our culture where it is now and where it's going to be. Man, that is a tall, tall order. It's a tall order. And I'm not entirely sure how we do it. I think the church forever has said, we're going to keep using the same methods that Billy Graham used back in the 60s and trust that those sermons and that environment and that calling is going to work tomorrow the same way that it worked yesterday. But I'm afraid that it won't. I'm afraid ultimately what made Billy Graham Billy Graham was he was pioneering. He was doing things that had been done a little bit, but he perfected some new things that resonated with that time and what was going on in the life of our country and with people he spoke to, you know, to some of those issues. And ultimately the church today in large part, they haven't figured out yet how to do the pioneering work of the evangelist to a society that is constantly changing. Because if you come up with a method that works today, whereas back then you might have a 20 or 30 year window, you come up with a method that's effective today, man, you might have a 5-year window in the thought process of our world. Every generation is its own culture. You know, my kids are growing up in a totally different culture than I did. My grandkids will be a different one still. And so, man, how do we do this? The reason I prayed what I prayed, and I didn't even talk about the next chapter, which talks about how in light of all of this in the U.S., the church is still strong. You know, it's still strong. It's becoming much more urban. Your biggest, most effective, most influential churches are Houston, Dallas, Atlanta, Chicago, places like that. What used to be the strength of the church, you know, the rural, small town, country town, farm town, First Baptist and First United Methodist churches, those are churches that, you know, in some places are closing up shop, closing their doors because, you know, you're just not as effective in places like that. But the church continues to be strong and growing. But the other chapter, he talks about how the Christian church that forever was a Western entity, Western Europe and then Euro-America, United States and Canada, has become more and more and more a global entity just over the last 100 years. The church in India growing. The church in Africa growing like crazy. The church in Latin America, whatever you think of Catholics, there are more confessed Christians in Latin America by percentage than any other continent in the world. You know, Brazil, I think, is 90%+ Christian. Now, we can always go and say, yeah, but what if, or are they really, or based on what theology, but look, Christian church in the name of Jesus, you know, salvation is by faith. I'm gonna hold to some hope there. China continues to be under a very challenging, China, other parts of Asia, under very challenging governmental regimes. The Christian church continues to grow. And so, you know, it's easy for us as Americans to look around and be a little unsettled by some of the conversations and turmoil and political issues and things of this nature. But as sons and daughters of God, as children of the King, as followers of Jesus, the Christian church, I mean, we have to believe that all of this history we've looked at over the last 9 months going, I mean, who would have ever thought that from 11 cowardly men who abandoned Jesus at the cross would come this, where we are today. Who would have ever thought? And to me, it's one of the great proofs of the resurrection of Jesus is the transition in those men and the power that they went out with and the spread of the Christian church from a little isolated, uneducated, you know, pocket cell within a small backwater country to the Christian church as it exists in all its many forms and views and beliefs and traditions, the Christian church being what it is around the globe. And so it's, you know, through wars, through reformations, through popes, through, you know, splinter groups, through heresies, through creeds and orthodoxies and, you know, through all these things, it's almost like the Church of Jesus continues to grow in spite of our best efforts to screw it up. In spite of humanity's best efforts to screw it up, you know, the church continues to grow. I mean, were there Christians in favor of Nazism in Germany? Absolutely there were. Were there Christians in favor of carrying on the slave movement, you know, during the Civil War? Yes, there were. Were there Christians against Martin Luther King during the Civil Rights? Yes, there were. I mean, if you want to find a negative face to put on Christianity, you don't have to look very hard. But at the same time, the kingdom of God advances. It's miraculous. It is, as who was it? It was in the book of Acts where one of the Sadducees, when they were persecuted, they were trying to decide what to do with Peter and John. Thank you. Gamaliel. Was it Gamaliel? And he said, my recommendation to you is just let them go. He says, if this is a thing of man, then it will fizzle and die out. But if this is a thing of God, you're only going to find yourself fighting against God. Yeah. And I think that's pretty potent. I mean, that is a prophecy, an accidental prophecy is what that is. And when you look at the history of the church and you look at where we are today, are we perfect? Of course not. Do we have a long ways to go? Of course we do. Do we have challenges as Christians in America that we're going to wrestle with the rest of our lives? Absolutely we do. But isn't there some confidence in knowing that if this was not a thing of God, it probably would have fizzled and died out and had lots of chances to do that any number of times. And yet, to fight against it would be to find yourself fighting against the hand of God himself. And so when I catch myself, you know, tossing and turning at night, not being able to go to sleep, being in my role as voice and leader over our group, I'm reminded that God's driving this bus somewhere. And our job is to get on board and play a part. I'm constantly challenged by the ethics of the gospel. And we want to be not only talking and preaching, but living the ethics of the gospel, recognizing that that's not always clear exactly how we do that in a way that's concurrent with the world in which we live in. But we as a church, we have to ask those questions and have those conversations and wrestle with the consequences of them, because that's our job. That's the church's job. That's our role. So, thoughts or comments? That's maybe more heavy stuff than you anticipated coming in. Chapter 36. If you don't have the book, if you do have the book, I'd encourage you to read it. And if you don't, borrow it from a friend. And you can also read 37. He talks a lot more about the growth of the church in the rest of the world. But pretty engaging stuff to wrap up with. Larry, did you read it? Did you? It's pretty good, right? You probably read it last fall. Well, yeah. Yes, yeah. Deja vu of a sort, right? Yeah. Well, yeah. Hey, I've got one more public speaking engagement before I get out on sabbatical, so I'm here doing a women's ministry thing tomorrow, but otherwise, I bid you all a fond adieu until August 21st. Put it on your calendar. I'll be back then, so yeah, don't burn the place down while I'm gone. And in the fellowship hall? I could do it. My wife and kids will probably, when we're in town, they'll probably be here. So you'll see them. Man, the attitude of the founders of the sabbatical policy was, if the church is going to give you this time, and we believe rest and renewal is important enough to give you this time, then you better do it. And listen, man, trying to stay away from here and trying to check out of stuff is already, I've just tried to start this week, and it's already proving to be immensely difficult, because it's just every waking minute of every day. And that is both why I love this place and why I love you and why this is going to be really hard, but probably also speaks to the reason why it's in place. So it's like going to the doctor for a checkup, right? You know it's healthy and you're supposed to do it, but that doesn't really mean that you're real excited to go. Once I get gone, I leave on Sunday. I fly to Moscow, and if you guys want to be in prayer for me, I'm teaching at the Logos Theological Center in Moscow the week of the 8th, and I'll be speaking at their commencement ceremony the end of that week. And then the following Tuesday, I travel from Moscow to Amsterdam, and I'm going to be visiting with a big international Baptist church there, and also lecturing and speaking at Tyndale Theological Seminary, which is located right there near the school. So week in Moscow, week in Amsterdam, and then from there on, it's kind of floating. So I'll be back here visiting churches around Houston. And then July, the whole month of July, we're going, all four of us are going to South Africa to work with our mission partners there. So we will be the other side of the world for a month. And then back here in August, first 3 weeks in August, just trying to rest and get ready. On the 21st of August, tomorrow, Laura's doing a just testimony thing, and so I'm just talking some of my story. On August 21st, I'm going to come back, and I thought about doing this a couple of times over the last year and a half, just taking a Sunday morning and revisiting my personal testimony, my story of salvation, call to ministry, my journey in ministry. Those of you that were here when I was hired heard all of that. You may not remember it, but we did all of that in the conversations and the interviews and the meet and greets prior to my coming here. But probably 50% or more of the people that are worshiping with us now are people that have come since I came and have never heard, you know, my story and some of the struggles and past. And so I thought that'd be a good way to segue back in. And then we're doing One Big Happy Family. That's the fall series, the Abrahamic Covenant and the Patriarchs. So we'll be Abraham, Jacob, and Joseph in the Old Testament for the fall. So you can look forward to that. But love you guys. Have a great summer if I don't see you again. And I'll catch up with you on August 21st, and then we'll reconvene back here on Wednesdays after Labor Day.